I was already going to speak on a certain topic today, and I had to think about it a little bit and revisit to see whether I would go ahead with it, but I decided I would. In some ways, it may seem unrelated, but I think when we get to the spiritual application of it, it can be. I had written down in my notes that the words I wanted to start the sermon with, I wanted to start saying, our world, it seems, has been infected. And that's the way I wanted to begin the sermon, so I still will. And even with the information and the news we had last night and through the night and this morning in Cleveland, I'm not talking just about COVID-19. Although, as of course Mr. Kuntz mentioned, it's been a difficult couple of years. And it has now been that length of time since it's called COVID-19 because the first instance of it was discovered or labeled and backtracked into the year 2019, late in the year. And we're now into 2022. So we're on the verge, really, of entering the third year of our common experience with this pandemic. And I know that we all hope and pray for relief to see it simply become endemic, where I guess you could say that that's it's always around, but it's not dominating our lives and determining our life patterns the way the pandemic has, and in these last 2 years. Especially when we see challenges hit our church family. Many of you also knew Chris Carruthers, a member in Akron who died shortly after the feast. And we've had our members here in Youngstown who have struggled with it and are still not quite ready to come back and rejoin us. And we certainly hope and pray for continued strengthening in their cases too. This has been a long, difficult stretch. But what I'm talking about today, and it's also not the focus of the sermon, that's not what I want to focus about, but when I say infection, this is what I mean. I'm talking about not a virus, but the poison of divisiveness and more or less constant strife in our world. That's what has infected our world. And of course, it doesn't date to only 2 years ago. It goes back much, much further than that, but it does seem to have intensified in recent years. It's always been a major factor in the wars of the human race. Every time you talk about a war, it always begins with division somewhere, somehow, strife somewhere, somehow. It's a factor and has been in many ways in politics, in the way nations govern themselves and the way they deal with each other. Years and years ago, there was a classic text written in the subject of international relations by Hans J. Morgenthau, a very famous scholar, and it was titled Politics Among Nations. But what it's really about is how nations respond to and deal with each other. And they all operate, as he points out, according to their national interests. They're concerned about what their interests are. Mr. Kuntz quoted from Mr. Frank's letter where he said one author has likened this to the 1930s, this time we're in now, and a time, as he said, especially it was true of the United States, that nobody was anxious to go to war for something that was happening half a world away. We hadn't yet figured out that you can't hide from it. Following World War II, it became more clear, and basically this country's approach and dealings on the international scene have changed post-World War II. We were forced to take a more prominent role of leadership in the world because the World War II turned out in some ways to be the last dying gasp of the influence of the British Commonwealth and the British Empire. The empire is gone. The Commonwealth still exists, but the empire is gone. And once we said the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, it set a long time ago in that sense. Most of its dominions and possessions have been given away or made independent, and that's all a part of a general direction and a trend of prophecy that we would have expected. But that's our world. That's the way things have always happened. But once in a while, here and there, there has always been a sort of a positive glimmer now and then of something that's a little more ennobling, something that's a little more of an effort to advance beyond those things. What I'm talking about is something that actually goes back into the last years of the 19th century in terms of its modern application, and that's the what we call the modern Olympics. First time occurred in 1896 in Athens, Greece, and has been conducted every 4 years with three misses. Do you know when those misses occurred and why? 1916, because of a little thing called World War I, and 1940 and 1944, because of something called World War II. So even there, here's this attempt to bring the youth of the world together to meet on a field not of battle, but of sport, and to do the best that they can, to contribute the best that they are capable of, and each one to even support the others as well. Now, of course, there's national interest there too, and there's been plenty of that. And even the Olympic Games, as we know, have been and are tainted by what probably Abraham Lincoln would have called the darker angels of our nature, because they too have had politics enter in so many times. But you know, I guess you've probably heard the definition of clinical insanity. And that is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. I still, every time the Olympics come around, I still get excited about them. I still enjoy them. This last summer, it was a little bit of a downer. It was a year late, first of all, because of COVID, and because of the timetable and the pressure and the stress to finish up and get ready for the last part of the class that I've been asked to teach at FI. And because of the lateness of the hour most of the time, I just didn't get to enjoy as much of it this past time around as I typically have and I'm used to. But I do enjoy the Olympics. And so maybe it's clinical insanity, but I'm still hoping. Because on February the 4th, 2022, the 24th Winter Olympiad will begin. Hasn't gone as long as the Summer Games, and as you no doubt know, they shifted it to be 2 years off the Summer Games back in 1994. You had Winter Olympics in 92, same year as the summer, and then they said, let's do it again in 94 and do an offsetting thing so it's not all the same year every time. This time it's hosted by China. It's based in Beijing, but not only are there different venues, the events will be conducted in three different time zones, which will, I'm sure, be a little bit challenging. And it lasts 16 days, ending February 20th. Again, I'm hopeful. I'm fully well aware of some of the politicking and the overtones involved. Fully aware of that. But something about it is appealing. And when you think about it from the perspective of God's Word, it does show the possibility of a goal that is a reasonable and uplifting and noble goal if only human beings could approach it in a godly way. If only they could use God's Spirit in the approach they take. Maybe that's part of the reason He loves His creation so much, that He can see in ways we cannot what could be. What could be. We had a split sermon format this morning in Cleveland as well, and Mr. Matt Pavlik, one of our elders, over there, you may have heard of the Roman historians Pliny the Elder and Pliny the Younger. Well, over there we have a Mr. Patchinger and a Mr. Pavlik, so the Clevelanders call them Mr. P the Elder and Mr. P the Younger, sort of like the Roman historians. But this was Mr. P the Younger, Matt Pavlik, and he talked about some of those things in his message about justice and mercy. Now, they must go together. In fact, judgment and mercy, how they must go together, because as he pointed out, some people take the approach, you know, they don't understand what Jesus meant when he said, judge not that you be not judged, but then later he said, judge righteous judgment. His point was, if we can't judge righteously, if you judge something, you can't have mercy unless there is first a judgment passed. And there's quite an interesting connection in that. Well, that's a little bit like what's going on in our world and a little bit like the issues with the Olympics. I'm saddened by it, but I still have hope. Because somehow, historically, the modern Olympic Games have shown some of the most inspiring moments in sports and in human life itself, if only. If only. But I want to get to a spiritual application as we go through today. They've shown moments of supreme effort, the strength of will in the midst of oppression. Two of the most famous Olympians in recent times, certainly one, actually hailed from Cleveland originally, Jesse Owens. In 1936, I'm sure you've all heard the story many times, that he won 4 gold medals in Berlin in 1936 in what's sometimes been called the Hitler Olympics. He destroyed the myth of Aryan supremacy. Hitler refused to greet him personally, as might have been expected. Of course, that was his view of the fact that an African American had won these medals. One of the things that came about, too, another Cleveland athlete by the name of Harrison Dillard, also an African American, a few years later, disqualified from his specialty in the Olympic trials. He was a specialist in the 110-meter high hurdles, knocked over a hurdle, and was disqualified. So he decided if he can't win a race that has hurdles and obstacles, he would try for something without. So he then qualified in the 100-meter dash and ended up winning the gold in an event that wasn't what he trained in. It was a photo finish by an eyelash, but he won. 4 years later, just to top it off, he qualified in especially the 110-meter high hurdles and won gold 4 years later. The only man ever to win gold in the 100-meter dash and the 110-meter high hurdles. He just died 2.5 years ago in Cleveland. He was 96 years of age. And there's a statue of him at Baldwin Wallace University on the west side of Cleveland near Berea. What about Paris, 1924? Eric Liddell, the Scottish sprinter, refusing to compete in the 100-meter qualifying heats on the day he mistakenly believed to be the Sabbath. He thought Sunday was the Sabbath, and he didn't want to compete on that day. So Lord Andrew Lindsay, a young nobleman who had already won a silver medal in a shorter hurdle race, said, "I'm supposed to compete in the 400 meters. I'll pull out and let Eric Liddell run the 400. The 400 was his third best event. He did get a bronze medal in the 200 in the same Olympics. And so he ran in his third best event, the 400 meters. And not only did he set a new world record time of 47.6, he beat the second place finisher by 5 meters. And 400 meters, that's gigantic. That was quite a moment. They made a movie featuring that called Chariots of Fire. Some of you may recall it from many years ago. Then there was American Billy Mills, orphaned at age 12, who grew up cared for by a sister and other relatives on the Lakota Sioux Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. He, in the last few steps of the 10,000-meter run in Tokyo in 1964, he and Mohamed Gamoudi, I believe was his first name, from Tunisia, were the only two who could stay with Ron Clark, the world record holder in the event, the one frequently expected to win. And somehow, in the last lap, nearly getting boxed out, getting jostled to the side of the track by other runners, in the last 50 meters of the 10,000 meters, Billy Mills sprinted past them both and won the gold. The only time an American man has ever won the 10,000 meters in the Olympics. A new Olympic record. Probably what was most astonishing was that he had only run the event a handful of times in his life, and he beat his previous best by almost 50 seconds, which is incredible. He had never broken 29 minutes before. His gold medal Olympic record time was 28:24.4. Astonishing moment. One of the commentators from, I think it was NBC News, calling the event got so beside himself with excitement that he just started screaming into the microphone, "Look at Mills! Look at Mills! Look at Mills!" And he was fired by NBC afterwards for not preserving the decorum expected of, you know, of an announcer. I think the other network should have picked him up immediately to deal with that. And there have been some spectacular principled moments. In that same 36 Olympics, Jesse Owens, the same one with what's been called the boys in the boat, the University of Washington eight-oared rowing team that had the best qualifying time in the semis, but instead of being given the best lane assignment, were given the worst and won anyway, as Hitler turned on his heel and left the facility. But German long jumper Lutz Long watched Jesse Owens scratch or foul in his first two attempts at the long jump. He hit the landing board, stepped over the line, and fouled. One more attempt. If he scratched on that, he was out of the event. Lutz Long had a chance to win it. He went over and picked up an exercise towel and put it down about a foot or more in front of the landing board and just looked at Owens and nodded, as if to say, this is your marker. You just have to jump from here. Jesse Owens won the gold medal Lutz Long might have had. Those are moments that you look for. 1964 at Innsbruck, the Winter Olympics, an Italian bobsledder, Eugenio Monti, helped a team from Great Britain win the gold by giving them an axle bolt from his own sled to repair their sled after his run. That's what you hope for. In Turin, or Torino, as it's called there, in 2006, Norway's cross-country ski coach, I will attempt to pronounce the name. I don't know if I'll have any more luck than Mr. Kuntz on pronouncing that Japanese approach to life, but his name was Bjørnar Håkonsmoen. How's that for an attempt? If anybody knows Norwegian, please let me know how that was. He gave a Canadian skier his own pole to replace the one she had just broken. It made it possible for her team to win the silver medal and push his own nation's team into a medalless fourth place out of the bronze medal that they might have had. The coach was showered with gratitude and praise for this act of sportsmanship, and he was surprised. His team had discussed this sort of thing the night before, and they all agreed that the right thing to do would be to help any competitor who needed a pole or a ski, no matter the circumstances, no matter what it meant for their team. After all, he said, isn't that what real sports are about? That act of sportsmanship cost his team a medal, but it won his country worldwide respect and admiration. Those things call to mind the motto of the modern Olympics. You've probably heard it in Latin, Sitius, Altius, Fortius. It means faster, higher, stronger. Proposed by Pierre de Coubertin, the creation of the International Olympic Committee in 1894, he borrowed it from a friend, Henri Didon, who was a Dominican priest and an athletics enthusiast. It was introduced as the Olympic motto in 1924 at the Paris Games. There's another one de Coubertin is also credited with. It came from a sermon by the Anglican Bishop of Pennsylvania, and the phrase was, the most important thing is not to win, but to take part. They sometimes call that the Olympic Creed. As usual, I'm going to ask you a question. What in the world does that have to do with us? Interesting stuff, yes. Fascinating, inspiring in some ways. Well, brethren, it has a lot to do with us. The analogy of athletics in God's Word is not new. Paul especially used it frequently alongside another analogy that also appears to have been one of his favorites for getting a point across, and that was the analogy of fighting a spiritual battle. He used them both. Turn to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. You're very familiar with a section on the armor of God. We had the theme of the Winter Family Weekend this year was armor up. If you haven't yet seen some of the seminars that were conducted Sabbath morning, or if you missed the Bible study or the Sabbath service for some reason, they are available on Kagwa TV. You can still look at those. They don't have all the FI classes. Those were only available for those who attended them. But you do have the chance to listen to the Bible study, the Sabbath service, and two Sabbath general seminars if you haven't heard them yet. They were all excellent. In Ephesians 6, we know this section about the armor. Brethren, verse 10, be strong. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. We've heard those words before. We know the analogy, a Roman soldier. My brother has written quite a series on Life, Hope, and Truth about the individual pieces of armor in this section. It's the other Dave Johnson, I guess you'd say. The FI instructor says he's had a lot of people come up to him and thank him for that series, and he says, I'd like to take credit for it, but it's not me. So my brother has done quite a bit of work in researching what the pieces of armor were, what they did, how they were used, and drawing the analogies for us. And there's a lot there. But what's the other analogy that Paul immediately works in verse 12? It's about fighting a spiritual battle, but look at the way he leads into it. He says, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. That was a well-known sport in his day. It has survived to this day in a similar form of Greco-Roman style wrestling. And it was quite well-known back in the world of the first century. Sports. For some reason, he felt he could use that analogy to connect to people in their world back then, in a way that people would understand back then. Now, I know sports is not everybody's cup of tea, if you want to put it that way. I understand that. But there are some things to be learned in lots of parts of human experience. And sometimes when there's one that has once in a while a glimmer of something to appreciate, something to recognize, a strong effort put in, and Paul constantly came back to it and said, this is like what we're supposed to do. We are to be good soldiers of Jesus Christ. We are to wrestle against the foes that we find. We don't wrestle against flesh and blood. Our adversaries are not another opponent on the mat in a wrestling arena, but they're principalities and powers and rulers of the darkness of this age, spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. And he used the analogy to get to it. They were two that were clearly connected in his mind. And both analogies brought out the desire to excel in him in the right way. Not in warfare, not in athletics, but in character development. As you read some of his letters, you can't miss that. Along those lines, some of the explanations of the Olympic motto or the Olympic creed might have been written for true Christians in a different setting. Here's one description. The Olympic Games is the international arena viewed by millions where the athlete's spirit, mind, and body endeavor to excel and achieve a higher standard than the presently existing ones. Isn't that what we're all about? Striving to overcome, to achieve a higher standard, to reach what is humanly impossible. But with God's help, is possible. With his Spirit providing the strength we need, it is possible to live a life that is dedicated to him. Perfect? Not in the sense we think of, no. The word is often used in the New Testament and sometimes is translated mature, spiritually mature. Paul talks about growing up into him. You and I all have some spiritual maturing to do. And the thing is, we will never stop. We will never reach a point where we can sort of, you know, dust off our hands and say, there, I finally reached the acme, the pinnacle of spiritual development. We'll never get there. The goal will always be in front of us. That's like athletics too. What is the limit of human performance in some of these events? Back in the 1930s, a sports medical expert confidently wrote down the limit of human performance in about 10 of the most common events. I think all but one or two have been broken since. And he said, you'll never do more than this. You can't ever run a mile faster than whatever, 4 minutes. Well, now what is it? It's not run anymore commonly. It's the Olympic distance of the 1,500 meters. But once in a while, the old mile is still contested, and the record is down in the 3 minutes and 40-some-odd seconds range, long past 4 minutes. There is never reaching an end of it. Never. There's always a goal to achieve a higher standard than the presently existing one. That should be our goal in our lives too. Here's another description. The creed and motto are meant to spur the athletes to embrace the Olympic spirit and perform to the best of their abilities. Isn't that what God asks of us? To use not the Olympic spirit, but the Holy Spirit. To live to the best of what He can give us in His strength. How many times have we read the famous verse of Philippians 2, verse 5, where we're told, "Let this mind be in you." Let this mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus. Let this mind. Have we ever, or will we ever, in the physical flesh, reach the perfection of the mind of Jesus Christ? I can confidently tell us all, we don't ever need to worry about reaching that goal and just crossing it off and saying, there, that goal's accomplished. We can always be aiming at that goal. Always. And that's, there's something reassuring in that. That there's always something more to learn, something more to glean. You pick up points that are deep and serious and good. You pick up more and others, even from messages that you hadn't counted on picking up. I gained one today in Mr. Kuhn's message. I've learned that I shouldn't be numbering my points in a sermon. I should be using letters. It's harder for people to keep track that way how far they have to go. No. There's always so much to learn. Here he's looking at one chapter of the Bible and expanding it, exploding it for us to think about. Is there ever an end to it? There's something reassuring in that. Turn to Galatians chapter 2. And let's see just a few of these expressions that Paul felt were helpful enough for him to use as a comparison. Now, the Olympic Games, of course, were in ancient world as well. They began well before Paul. But there were games in his own area that were part of the Roman Empire. They were known as the Isthmian Games, I-S-T-H-M-I-A-N, something to do with the word Isthmus, which I have trouble pronouncing, Isthmus and Isthmian Games anyway. But he was quite familiar with them, and he used that analogy in his letters. Look at Galatians 2, then after 14 years, verse 1, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas and took Titus with me. And I went up by revelation, and I communicated to them that gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but privately to those who were of reputation. I think we know the story, how he'd been taught and trained, we believe, by Jesus Christ himself in private for 3 years in a deserted area of Arabia. But that was in chapter 1. But his reason for it was to compare notes. And then he says, here's why, lest by any means I might run or had run in vain. That's an athletic analogy. He's comparing it to the games that were well known in the first century in his area of the world. And those who were listening and reading his letters would know what he was talking about. And they could put a visual comparison to it of a competition of runners in a race. And seeing Paul saying, I don't want to find myself in a race that nobody's even in. Nobody else is here. It's just me, and it doesn't mean anything. No, I want to be running alongside my colleagues in the ministry. I don't want to run in vain. He even has overtones of working together, sort of like, you know, a relay race. Run in vain. Let me ask a question, just hearkening back to the physical for a moment. Does any Olympic athlete ever run in vain? Can you ever say about any Olympic athlete, well, what's the point? I mean, they finished last. Why did they even bother? I don't think so. Especially at that level. I know something of finishing last in high school races. It's not fun, but somebody's got to do it. And it was nicer when it wasn't, you know, when you moved up a few notches. Maybe all the other ones had the flu that day or something, but, you know, you move up a few notches and it feels a little better. But at that level, what about the person who finishes last? They're still able to call themselves on that level an Olympian. Some of you probably go far enough back to remember Eddie the Eagle from the Calgary Games in 1988. A ski jumper. Eddie wasn't athletic at all. He was just determined, a determined young man. And as it turned out, Britain really had no ski jumpers. So somehow he managed to meet the absolute minimum qualifications to be in the Olympics that year, and he finished dead last. And he was so excited about landing his jumps that he would hit the slope and run it out, and then he'd just go around flapping, and they started calling him Eddie the Eagle. Go, you know, fly, Eddie. I take a look at the 70-meter ski jump hill, and I get vertigo, and I look at the 90-meter ski jump hill, and I'm terrified, and he did them both. He was dead last, but when he got back to England, he was a sensation. Now, they went and passed rules that made it impossible for someone who was not any better than he was to qualify again, which is maybe sad. But he could say that all of that effort meant something. The same Olympics, 1988 Calgary, saw for the first ever time a Jamaican bobsled team in the Winter Olympics. Now, spoiler alert, they made a Disney movie about it that is, let's just say, somewhat factually sketchy and factually challenged. The supposed coach that coached the team didn't exist. There was no such person. The team members were actually mostly Army personnel, but they were athletes from Jamaica. And they actually had a shot at a medal late in the Olympics, except their rickety old sled broke apart on their final run. I can't even imagine the speed those things attained down those slopes during the tracks, the bobsled track. But they insisted on finishing the race. The movie had them picking up the bobsled and carrying it across the line. They actually pushed it across the line, but then I guess it made for a good Hollywoodization. Hollywood always has to change things up a little bit. But they actually qualified for the succeeding Olympics 4 years later. And I'll have a special memory of the 1988 Olympics because we were living at the time in Eastern Ontario, based in Ottawa as the pastor. And my assistant and I had a ministerial trainee working with me at the time, and we were out visiting north of the city in the province of Quebec, outside Ontario. And we noticed as we were getting close, it was wintertime. I don't remember whether it was December of 87 or January sometime of 88. But as we were driving, we noticed that ahead of us on kind of a small country lane, there was a hazard light flashing, vehicles, and there was a group ahead of the vehicles. Well, we couldn't see until we got up closer, until we passed the Olympic torch being run between Montreal and Calgary that year. It had been sent by ship to Montreal and was run across in relays across the country to Calgary. That was quite a moment to watch the torch being transported. I'll remember that. Then there was Derek Redmond, the British record holder in the 400 meters in 1992 at the Barcelona Olympics in Spain. In the semifinals, midway through the race, he snapped his right hamstring and went down like a shot. Went down like they say, as if he'd been pole-axed. He collapsed on the track, but after all the other runners had passed him, he struggled to his feet and he started hopping toward the finish line. His father came out of the stands, put his arm around his shoulders, and together they finished the lap. He was given a standing ovation. Was finishing last so terrible for Derek Redmond? He's had a very successful career since, athletics and coaching. What about John Stephen Akwari? Tanzania, Mexico City, 1968. He was competing in the marathon, small little event, just 26 miles, 385 yards. Mexico City is at quite an elevation. He was from Tanzania. He had never trained at altitude. About halfway through the race, not quite halfway, he developed severe cramps. And in doubling over and bending, he began to weave. And some of the other runners, in jockeying for position, somebody hit him and knocked him down. Unintentionally, but knocked him down. He scraped his shoulder on the pavement, but worse, he dislocated his knee. John Stephen Akwari refused to stop. He still had more than 13 miles to go. He ended up, there were 75 runners who started the race. 18 of them dropped out. More than 20%. John Stephen Akwari was not one of them. They had the medal ceremony. Mahout Gamoudi, sorry, not Mahout, it was I'll think of it later, from Ethiopia. Another runner from Ethiopia finished in gold, won the gold that year. But about an hour after the ceremony, after the finish of the race and the medal ceremony, the stadium was mostly emptied, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people later, and somebody alerted them that there was one runner still out on the course. So the photography crew, the video crew that had videoed the medal ceremony, went out to find him, and he was just coming into the stadium, into the arena. He was limping, but he circled the track, and he finished the race over an hour after the winner. They interviewed him and asked him later why he continued to run when 18 runners had dropped out without injuries like that. His answer: my country did not send me 5,000 miles to start the race. They sent me 5,000 miles to finish the race. And he did. They were all Olympians. They had the opportunity to march into the stadium under their nation's flags in the opening and closing ceremonies and to strive for something of value in their minds. Now, they all had to be gifted athletically in one way or another to start. I understand that. But it took effort and training and character and absolute determination to reach a goal. Do you see or hear anything in that that sounds familiar, brethren? What about you and me? Are we doing that? Are we giving our all? No matter what the difficulties of life may dish out to us, you heard the first message today. Be of good cheer. In this world you will have tribulation. I have overcome the world. Some of these athletes overcame an incredible amount of setbacks to even be where they were. And I know, it's sad. There have also been doping scandals in the history of the Olympics where those who won turned out to have been cheating, using banned substances and so on. I can't imagine how much of a sort of a, in one sense, a letdown it would be. Suppose you had been the one awarded the silver medal at the medal ceremony and then found out you actually had the gold, but in that sense, you didn't share the glory that the gold should have merited. There's the corruption. There's the challenge. There's the way our world operates. Someday that's going to change. Let's keep looking just for the last little bit here of some of Paul's descriptors. The book of Hebrews is not identified. The author is not identified in the book, as with all the other letters we know were written by Paul, the other 13. This one traditionally we believe to have been, maybe not. There are parts of it that make me think he was the author. His references to Timothy and Titus seem to be unique to him. And the way he talks about them, there are other approaches and analogies we see. But I've long ago decided that if Barnabas comes up to me in the first resurrection and says, I wrote the book of Hebrews, what are you talking about? I'm going to say, I'm good with that. I'm fine. It was you. It doesn't matter who wrote it. It's inspired by God. And in Hebrews 12 and verse 1, it says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, sounds like a completely filled Olympic stadium to me. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. I read those words and I think of John Stephen Akwari from Tanzania. My country did not send me 5,000 miles to start the race. My God did not call me and give me His Spirit to start the Christian race. He sent me and called me and gave me His Spirit to finish the race. And that's why we're here. And we consider, as he says in verse 2, the one who ran the race first. The author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, has sat down at the right hand of God. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. This one is, we know, is identified by Paul as the author. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24, he says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race," here he goes again, "all run, but one receives the prize. Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate," or exercises self-control "in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Thus I run, thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air." One translation says, "I am not shadow boxing. I do not shadow box. There's a purpose to my fight, to my battle, to my contesting the event. But I discipline my body." That sounds familiar to anybody who's competed in athletics over the years. "And bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." There are analogies. The spiritual discipline required is a far greater view than a temporary physical discipline. Harrison Bones, as he was known, Bones Dillard, just died 2.5 years ago in Cleveland at the age of 96. He still looked to be in pretty good shape, but I'm quite sure he couldn't still run the 110-meter high hurdles at the age of 96. And yet, in 1952, in the Olympics, he won gold in that event, 4 years after winning gold in the 100 meters. Time takes it away. Not what we're searching for. Not what our goal is. It is permanent. It doesn't go away. It is eternal. We do it for an imperishable crown. Those are the things we need to think about. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Second Timothy 2 and verse 1. "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus." You're going to hear both analogies here. "And the things that you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." There's one analogy he uses frequently. "No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier." And also, here comes the other analogy. "If anyone competes in athletics, he is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. And if you cheat, and if you get found out with the blood test, they take away the medals. It doesn't count anymore." That's the way it is with us too. In serving God, there are no shortcuts into the kingdom of God. If you're out on the course for the marathon, you can't jump in a cab and go for 5 miles and then finish it after that. You've got to run 26 miles, 385 yards, or about 42 kilometers. That's the way it works. And that's the way our life works, as you heard in the first message. Obedience is required. Following God's rules, His laws, is required. That's the standard. And that's what he asks of us. Back to Hebrews chapter 12. We read verses 1 and 2, but let's take a look after that. Verses 3 and 4, he makes some pretty tough analogies here, some of them touching peripherally on the same analogy, others just standing alone. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. Verse 12. Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. I'm sure John Stephen Aquari had feeble knees. So did Derek Redmond when he snapped his hamstring in the semifinals. Make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be dislocated. That sounds familiar from our analogies today. But rather be healed. Pursue peace with all and holiness without which no one will see the Lord, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble and by this money become defiled. Verse 22, you have come, well, verses 18 and 19 first, you have not come to the mountain that may be touched and burned with fire and blackness and darkness and tempest. Our race is so much greater than any Olympic competition. They can be inspiring to those of us who enjoy sport. I love watching some of those things, you know, even some of the recreations, the miracle, the hockey winter team in 1980, the U.S. Olympics, Billy Mills race, and hearing that announcer going absolutely nuts in the, you know, the overtones. Look at Mills, look at Mills. But this is not what we're doing. The sound of a trumpet, the voice of words, so those who heard it begged the word shouldn't be spoken to them anymore. Verse 22, you've come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. See that you don't refuse him who speaks. If they didn't escape who refused him who spoke on earth, how much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven? His voice then shook the earth, but now he's promised once more, I shake not just the earth, but also heaven. And then it says, yet once more indicates the removal of those things that are being shaken. All of these things will come to be meaningless in one sense later on. But this is the training ground. This is the training regimen. This is the disciplining of ourselves by God's Spirit. Verse 28, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. The goal is out there. Those are powerful words, and in some ways they call to mind the Olympic motto, Sitius, Altius, Fortius, faster, higher, stronger. Where are we headed, brethren, you and I? What's the result of our training regimen, our desperate struggle, our efforts to be in spiritual good condition and shape? Look at Paul's last words. At least we believe they are his last words when he wrote the letter, 2 Timothy, we call it. You're familiar with it. You've read it many times. And to the end, what is the analogy that Paul used? Knowing his audience could understand it. 2 Timothy 4, verse 7, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. I have finished the race. Just like John Stephen Aquari, our Father did not call us to start the race. He called us to finish the race. Let's remember where we're headed, to somewhere that embodies faster, higher, stronger, more than any physical endeavor ever could.